This is Bondi Tunes International, the week that was.
The election report from Ronan Seagrave for Bondi Tunes International.
This is Bondi Tunes International broadcasting around the world. I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia. A quick hello to some of our listeners in Ireland at Slice Audio. I hope you're all well. And also in Ireland's Ferry FM in Portaferry near Belfast in Northern Ireland. A very good evening, morning or afternoon to you wherever you are. Ronan Seagrave's Irish. He's from Kells in County Meath. He's also our North America correspondent and joins me now from Winnipeg in Canada. Ronan, good evening to you.
Good evening, Henry.
Gosh, look, we got a lot to talk about. But first of all, you know, we were just talking off air, you know, about the coronavirus situation in Canada. Mm-hmm. And I read, it was quite shocking to me. I don't know if it is shocking figures in America and Canada, whether they're actually shocking for people there. But I'm reading new cases today alone, 4,345 in Canada.
Yes, I mean, we have, the fourth wave has arrived here, Henry, and it's impacting disproportionately two provinces, in particular, more than half the cases come from these two provinces. The first is the province immediately to the west of where I am in Manitoba and Saskatchewan. And then even more critically in the province of Alberta, where it's no exaggeration to say, Henry, that the health system is being overwhelmed there by COVID admissions. And the common thread with both of those two provinces, Henry, is that in July, the governments, the provincial governments there decided to basically drop all restrictions. So, you know, mask mandates went. Any form of really any kind of public health restrictions and even contact tracing went. It was, you know, pandemic's over, the show's over.
It's very, that's very Boris-like, isn't it?
Well, the problem was, Henry, they were basing that on overall in the provinces, you know, vaccination numbers that were sort of getting to sort of 70-75% double vaccinated. But there's two problems with that, Henry. Number one, we now know with the far more contagious Delta variant that you really have to get to 90% to get to anything like herd immunity. And secondly, those overall numbers masked huge regional variations, and particularly in the south and the north of both of those provinces that you could argue had with the Bible Belt sort of areas of those provinces.
Yes,
that there is an association here with sort of a Christian fundamentalism, for want of a better description, and anti-vaccination stuff. And in fairness, vaccine hesitancy, as opposed to sort of conspiracy theory types. Mm. But the result of that, and particularly Alberta, has been a devastating surge of admissions of very sick COVID-19 patients. I mean, there were over, I think, something like 312 patients in ICU in Alberta. Now, to put that into context, of their pandemic ICU bed baseline, that is 189% capacity. Obviously, you know, routine surgery has been completely cancelled. Doctors and nurses have been redeployed from other units and other parts of healthcare.
Ronan, are they
to
getting
deal with this expansion?
Are they getting doctors and nurses who've retired back into the system, like they are in some parts of Australia?
Yes, some. I mean, the majority though would be just simply other sort of routine, like elective surgeries, routine elective surgeries just ceasing and redeploying sort of nursing and indeed even physicians in those areas to deal with this surge. Over the weekend, they opened an additional 39 additional surge ICU beds. They've obviously had to look at nursing ratios and expand them, mm-hmm. Which obviously entails more risk. The situation, Henry, has been a political disaster for the Conservative Premier, Jason Kenney, who does preside over a very fractious caucus. It was actually, he presides over a party, Henry, that merged a few years ago from more sort of progressive conservatives, and there'd be people criticizing him, you know, for not going far and, you know, not having lockdowns and not just, know, removing the restrictions. And then people who are just saying we shouldn't have any restrictions at all, you know.
Yeah, of course, and you're always going to have that segment of the community. Just want to let our listeners know, in Canada, 1.612 million people have had, this is the total cases in this pandemic. Mm-hmm. As I said earlier on, 4.3 million people overnight. I mean, this number is horrific if you live in Australia. And active cases, 46,065. And people who have died, 27,698. What is it? I'm not sure if you've already answered this question, Roland, but what is the vaccination rate today? What percentage of Canada has either had one or two doses?
We're up to, Henry, sort of nationally over 80% with two doses, which is not bad. The focus is shifting, Henry, in three different areas in terms of getting that number really into the 90s. One is provinces are now adopting very kind of targeted strategies around the vaccine hesitant. That's a mixture, Henry, I would say, of carrot and stick, i.e. getting people to go to information sessions, having one-to-one counselling, like, why do you not want the vaccine? Have you been given misinformation? That kind of thing. Mm. But also more stringent measures such as sort of vaccine mandates. You know, if you work in certain frontline positions or for the government, it's either get vaccinated by a certain date or subject yourself to daily COVID testing. Also, Henry, what we call here vaccine passport. So I have on my phone and a plastic card, a QR symbol, which when I go into a restaurant or a bar, the person uses a QR reader and it flashes green saying double vaccinated, you're fine. So the only people in Manitoba who can go to a sporting event, who can go to a bar, restaurant, or any, aside from a shop, any kind of indoor activity, you must be double vaccinated and you must provide proof of that.
And that's, of course, par for the course really around the world, the developed world at least. I mean, we're having the same situation in Australia. There's a lot of people really annoyed. The Australian federal government says, oh, we're not going to make you get vaccinated, or the state governments here in Australia are saying, we're not going to make you get vaccinated, but you will be kind of like the great unwashed because you won't be able to do anything. If you're not fully vaccinated by some date in November, you won't have the same so-called freedoms as people who are fully vaccinated. This is causing a lot of ire, to use a word.
It is, Henry. I mean, on the one hand, you have people who come from a civil liberties, Canadian Charter of Human Rights and that perspective that, everyone has the right around their own body and what goes into their own body. However, certainly in Canada, legal rulings have come down, and even from the Supreme Court, that says that in the case of a public health emergency, such as the COVID-19 pandemic, those rights are superseded by the right to protect the public at large. Mm. So a pandemic requires different behaviours. It requires mass collective action, as opposed to individually deciding to make decisions. And part of that collective action is complying with public health measures and getting vaccinated. Mm. I'm not actually, Henry, somebody other than people who, in a frontline capacity and interacting with the public, I don't believe that mandatory vaccines would probably work. How would you do it? Would you start rounding people up and forcing needles into their arms?
I think
it is, as we're discussing, I think is a combination of levers. I mean, in Alberta, they'll actually pay you $100 to get vaccinated.
This whole business is very American as well, where you get incentives.
Correct.
And there's a lot of people who disagree with giving people incentives, particularly our own Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, in Australia, thinks it's a dreadful thing to do. What are your thoughts on that?
I have very mixed feelings, Henry. I mean, Alberta, it caused kind of some resentment by people who'd already got vaccinated and saying, well, I didn't get my $100.
Mm.
I think it's really, Henry, government's kind of desperate to get these numbers up, and they're willing really to try anything. None of them want to go down the path of total mandation, other than, as I say, for like healthcare workers and people working in certain professions where it's a statement of the obvious that those people do need to be double vaccinated. But they're trying what I call the carrots and the sticks. The sticks are, you can't really go anywhere and interact with other people in a public place other than to do your shopping unless you get double vaccinated. Mm. The sticks are, so that's the sticks. The carrots are things like lotteries, paying people. And actually, if you want to get back to anything like a normal life, you know what you've got to do. And this did play out, Henry, and we're going to talk about it. This did play out in the recent federal election we had here in Canada. Justin Trudeau, since 2019, has been leading a minority Liberal government and, yes. and has been reliant on...
Just before we get into that, I just, you know, I'm wondering, I just want to let our listeners know that you work in health. This is your gig.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm just wondering if people, get to the 80, 90% double vax, is that solving the problem?
No. No.
difficult question.
It's a very difficult question. I think it's important for listeners to understand that this pandemic is probably not going to end over the next 6 months. It is probably likely to last another year or two.
Yeah.
There are a couple of reasons for that. One is just simply the emergence of the Delta variant. And actually, you have to look at the thing globally, not just the countries we're talking about, but other countries around the world where vaccinations are still very low. Mm. There's the ever-present threat of another variant emerging that may be more vaccine resistant.
Yes.
What I do think will happen, Henry, is that very gradually, if we get global vaccination rates up and we dodge a bullet on another nasty variant, is that will become endemic. That means that health systems will be grappling with just flare-ups, maybe seasonal, in relation to COVID. We'll have a regime of booster shots. Obviously, the next wave of people to be vaccinated will be children between 5 and 11 once the Pfizer vaccine's approved. And booster shots, I think, with COVID will become part of our lives. Like getting your flu shot, you'll get your COVID shot. You'll get your COVID shot. If we get to globally, you know, 90% of the world vaccinated, the threat and fire of another variant that's vaccine resistant has been extinguished, then we can move into a sense of a new normal. I don't think it will ever be quite as it was.
Yes, we'll be calling them the good old days. If you just joined us, talking with Ronan Seagrave in Canada. The good old days, Ronan. You've got a teenage daughter. I always ask you this because I'm fascinated by how parents are dealing with their children, how children are dealing with a pandemic. And I get the feeling that they sort of, when you're a child, you sort of accept things more readily, don't you?
You do. I mean, children, in a way, the human race has survived for centuries and survived other plagues and pandemics by being adaptive. And this is another test for the human race to adapt to this and to get to a point where we can live with this virus. And I want to assure listeners we will, and there may be some slight variations. The masks may become seasonal for many years when we're going into indoor areas, but we'll learn to live with it. And I think my daughter is of that mindset. I think she's also very conscious that she is living through a genuinely awful, as it is, a historic period. You know, the COVID pandemic is one of the seismic events in the last 100 years of history.
Yeah.
And she's very conscious of that. And she's also been very conscious of doing the right things and wearing her mask. She's got vaccinated, taking all the necessary precautions. But, you know, kids adapt.
It's absolutely.
And they also can see that there will be better days ahead. Yeah. You know?
Okay, now look, you did mention a federal election. Now, maybe I have been living under a rock, but you didn't
miss much, Henry.
I know you did tell me that, you know, the date, and I sort of forgot because I hadn't spoken to you. And then all of a sudden, I found out on the web that you've had a federal election in Canada. Justin Trudeau is probably in the same place as he was in before.
More or less exactly the same, Henry. I mean, this was an unwanted election by just about everybody except Justin Trudeau. He had said he wasn't going to call an election in the middle of a pandemic. Well, he did. And the reason for that was he saying, you know, he was getting frustrated about getting his agenda through and reliant on minority parties like the left-leaning NDP and a bloc Quebecois, sort of Quebec nationalists. And he decided to call an election. And they were ahead in the polls, Henry, but in the first couple of weeks, the Conservatives, led by Aaron O'Toole, started to chip away at that lead and sort of becoming more dead heat. But then things started to go a bit wrong for Aaron O'Toole. He got caught up, Henry, in sort of flip-flopping around sort of vaccine mandates and a self-inflicted wound around wanting to relax gun laws, which really majority of Canadians are not in favour of, and he quickly abandoned that. I would have to say, Henry, it was a bitter, nasty and divisive election. I mean, Justin Trudeau was sort of haunted by sort of anti-vaxxers, conspiracy theory types, even had gravel thrown at him at one point at a rally. The People's Party, led by a guy called Max Bernier, People's Party of Canada, he was a former candidate for the leadership of the Conservatives, left the party in a huff. And I mean, the People's Party of Canada are hard right,
yes,
frankly, borderline fascists, yeah, anti-immigration, obviously, you know, anti-vaccine, all of that kind of stuff. And they chipped a bit at O'Toole's vote, but it produced almost, Henry, an identical result to the 2008 after all of this.
How was the turnout, Ronan?
Because
you don't have, just for our listeners on FM in Australia and New Zealand, you have to vote in Australia. It's mandatory. It's not in New Zealand, as it isn't in many countries. In Canada, it's not.
No, it was a low turnout, Henry. I mean, barely of up 60%, which showed the kind of indifference around it and apathy around it. For the Conservatives to win, Henry, they had to take seats in both Quebec, and O'Toole started sort of flirting with the nationalists there and, you know, saying he was in favour of sort of secular law there that sort of bans religious symbols. Well, that didn't play well with some of his base.
Yeah.
And he had to win seats in suburban ridings in Toronto and Ontario. He didn't win any of them, Henry, and actually dropped a few seats, lost a few seats in Alberta, probably anger about the COVID situation there. That's led, Henry, to a lot of soul-searching in the Conservatives. Do they stick with Aaron O'Toole, who did move the party right into the centre? You know, with some social liberalism was suddenly back in, very kind of liberal-like policies around spending lots of money on childcare and things like that.
He thought that would work, right?
He thought that would work, but it didn't work with the voters that he was targeting. And, you know, why vote for a paid imitation when you can vote for the real thing in Trudeau? And so they're sort of debating, Henry, whether to stick with O'Toole or have another leadership contest. My gut instincts, Henry, is that they will stick with him.
Is it 4 years?
Another election.
Another 4 years?
Yeah, well, this is it. Because it's another minority, we could have another election within 18 months and 2 years. Within 2 years. In fact, it's highly likely that we will.
That must cost a lot of money.
It cost, I believe, $600 million, Henry, this entire exercise. For absolutely nothing other than, I think, unnecessary inflaming divisions at a time when we could have done without it, Henry, to be honest, and just focused on the pandemic.
Yes.
So Trudeau is in the same position that he was. He will, for a lot of his agenda, Henry, he will get votes from the NDP, led by Jagmeet Singh, who basically flatlined on seats, also with the Quebec nationalists. So it'll be very much the same. I mean, you know, O'Toole could have... He sort of abandoned policies that also irritated Conservatives. For example, a lot of Conservative provinces had done deals with the Trudeau government for $10 a day daycare, you know, signed agreements. And then suddenly O'Toole comes out and says, well, I'm not in favour of it. And they're saying, why? This is an issue you should be fighting on. So for the Conservatives, Henry, their problem is to win in the Western Canada and the prairies, they like their red meat right-wing conservatism. That does not play well in Ontario and Quebec, where you've got to be more centrist, you've got to be socially liberal. So that kind of dilemma for the Conservatives to win again. Also, Henry, it would have to be fair to say that the Liberals themselves would be asking a few questions of Justin Trudeau.
Yes.
Like his decision to call this election, their actual share of the vote went down, even though through careful vote management, they retained more or less the same number of seats that they went out with. So there are mutterings there. Nothing to the extent, Henry, that I think his leadership's under immediate threat. But certainly people are saying that this really was a waste of time. You know?
Yes, okay.
Dad. Daddy started out in San Francisco, tooting on his trumpet loud and mean.
Suddenly a voice said, go for it, Daddy, spread the picture on a wider screen.
And the voice said, Daddy, there's a million pigeons waiting to be hooked on new religions. Hit the road, Daddy, leave your common law wife. Spread the religion of the rhythm of life. And the rhythm of life is a powerful beat. Puts a tingle in your fingers and a tingle in your feet. Rhythm in your bedroom, rhythm in the street. Yes, the rhythm of life is a powerful beat.
To feel the rhythm of life, to feel the powerful beat, to feel the tingle in your fingers, to feel the tingle in your feet.
Daddy spread the gospel in Milwaukee, took his walkie-talkie to Rocky Ridge,
blew his way to Canton, then to Scranton, till he landed under the Manhattan Bridge.
Daddy was a new sensation, got himself a congregation, built up quite an operation down below.
With a fire piper blowing, all the muscatel was flowing, all the cats were go-go-going
down below.
Daddy was a new sensation, got himself a congregation, with a fire piper and operation down.
Flip your wings and fly to Daddy. Flip your wings and fly to Daddy. Flip your wings and fly to Daddy. Fly, fly, fly to Daddy. Take a dive and swim to Daddy. Take a dive and swim to Daddy. Take a dive and swim to Daddy.
Swim, swim, and swim to Daddy.
Hit the floor and crawl to Daddy. Hit the floor and crawl to Daddy. And the rhythm of life is a powerful beat. Puts a tingle in your fingers and a tingle in your feet. Rhythm in your bedroom, rhythm in the street. Yes, the rhythm of life is a powerful beat. To your daddy, take a dive and swim to your daddy.
Bondi Tunes International, virus free. around the world and down your street.
Yeah, and if you've just joined us, this is Bondi Tunes International. I'm Henry in Sydney. Ronan is up there in Canada, in Winnipeg. Moving on to the German election, which is even more recent. Very interesting situation in Germany. Olaf Scholz of Germany's Social Democratic Party, the SDP, is sure to get into power after 14 years.
16, actually.
It's 16 years of Angela Merkel.
It is incredible to think that an entire generation has grown up, Henry, and the only chancellor of Germany they can remember is Angela Merkel. I mean,
it's hard to believe that it's a democracy when you think of it.
I know. I mean, Angela Merkel was an incredibly successful politician, you have to say that. I mean, she wasn't the most sort of visionary politician, but she was shrewd.
She's very smart.
Always
woman.
Governed right
in
the
centre. She's a scientist, actually.
She's a scientist, you know, careful, cautious, governed in the centre.
Yes.
You know, tough when it came to certainly sort of EU matters, as Ireland discovered in the banking bailout and Greece as well. Mm. She's always maintained the German, you know, fiscal discipline and having sound money are fundamentals.
And they are the end just of to, just to point out, they're still the biggest economy in Europe.
Oh, absolutely, and she's ensured that has continued to be the case. I think. This election again has shown, I think, a greater fragmentation of the vote. You know, the traditional sort of CDU, CSU, and SPD, they both, you know, dropped their percentage share. So we're looking at, and this, by the way, is going to take some months. I think Angela is probably still going to be Chancellor till near Christmas.
Yes.
It's likely to be a three-way coalition between the SPD, which is a sort of centre-left party. Angela was with the CDU, CSU, which is centre-right,
yes.
The Greens, and the FDP, who are sort of free market liberals. So you, on the face of it, it doesn't look like a straightforward.
No, it doesn't.
Coalition discussion.
It's like a melting pot of yes. different parts of politics.
But the thing about Germany, Henry, is that it views, because obviously of its history and Hitler and Nazism. It political stability is at its core, and there actually is law that if either of the two main parties, the SPD, CDU, CSU, can't form a coalition with other parties, they have to form a grand coalition. And in fact, the outgoing government was a grand coalition between the CDU, CSU, and SPD. Mm. This new government will not be. The numbers are there for this unique three party. Now, Germany has traditionally just had two parties in coalition, either the CDU CSU with the FDP or the SDP with the FDP or with the Greens. Mm. This will be unique in that three parties are going to have to come together, and everybody thinks this is going to take several months, and Angela will continue until a new government and Olaf Scholz is sworn in as a new chancellor.
I wonder what the young people of Germany think of this. Again, I don't think it's mandatory to vote in Germany. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out because, you know, I think people just want change. And often, you know, back in 1996, John Howard was prime minister, right-wing prime minister of the Liberal Party here in Australia. And he lost in 2007 after 13 years. And someone said, a broadcast colleague of mine who's, a journalist, he said, look, nothing else. People just want to change. It wasn't actually political. They just said, we want something new now.
Indeed. I mean, one wonders how sort of radical the change would be. I think in Germany, probably not a whole lot in terms of its sort of corporatist model. I think part of what I think has been dominating politics really since the financial crisis in 2008-10 is that you've an awful lot of people who in times past would have climbed up the ladder, Henry, you know, the middle class dream, a secure job, owning your own home. And if you look at what's been happening, you know, buying a home in many countries, including Canada, for young people is incredibly difficult and often requires sort of parental help. Job security, particularly now, obviously, with the pandemic on top of it, is not what it was. And you have a lot of people feeling uneasy, uncertain, angry maybe in some cases. And that reflects in countries like Germany and indeed Ireland and others in a much more sort of fragmented voting and people voting for you know, sort of very left-wing parties feeling that that might be the answer, traditional parties and their share of votes, you know, like Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael in Ireland, you could say SPD and CDU in Germany, losing their vote share, and that vote, those votes becoming much more fragmented against a range of parties on the right and the left. And I think that just reflects, you know, a change in society of people feeling that what happened with sort of previous generations where people could buy their own home, they had a, you know, a stable job and the American dream, if you like, or the Canadian dream, is not what it was, and people just feel very anxious about what the future may bring.
Of course, that really is across the world, isn't it? That whole dream of having your own home, very Australian as well. And you know, the thing is, I think that with regard to these elections, both in Canada and in Germany, social media has played a huge part in this role, hasn't it? And how damaging has it been? Damaging?
I'm not sure. I mean, again, there have been sort of various allegations in Canada, again, about the Chinese. And there's been a sort of backdrop of an issue involving, I can't remember her exact name, but she was the sort of head of finance for Huawei, who was arrested in Vancouver several years ago on an extradition warrant from the US. And she's been living in Vancouver, trapped in Vancouver ever since, sort of renting a house while legal proceedings have been playing out. And two Canadian gentlemen, businessmen, were detained in China. And immediately after the election, the extradition warrant for the Huawei executive was dropped. She returned to China and China freed these two Canadians. But the fraughtness with relations with China has led to allegations that they were sort of interfering in the election. To be honest, Henry, I don't think so, and I don't think it was a massive factor in the Canadian election.
Yeah.
Certainly, you know, it got very nasty. I mean, Aaron O'Toole, almost in desperation, unleashed very strong kind of personal attacks on Justin Trudeau. I don't think it made much difference. You know, people either like or don't like Justin Trudeau and made up their minds at that point. Yeah. But yeah, it adds to, Henry, I think, often a lot of poison in elections and personal attacks and personal abuse rather than debates on policy, you know?
Yes, of course, that's a given, isn't it? How did America react? Did America care, okay, with the Canadian election?
Probably not a whole lot. I mean, again, issues like pipelines came up. Yeah, Aaron O'Toole was broadly in favour of them. Trudeau was not so much. Mm. But I don't think this was something that was vexating Joe Biden. Barack Obama did come out on social media and endorse Justin Trudeau. I don't think that made any difference whatsoever.
Yeah.
I don't think Joe Biden's distracted by many other things right now. I don't think he was that focused.
He must have been so distracted when he was talking via satellite link on a kind of Zoom thing to the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the Australian Prime Minister, and the Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison.
Deal in China, yeah.
What did he say? Oh, our fella down under, because he forgot the Australian Prime Minister's name.
There is obviously, you know, concern around Joe, but I think that issue did come up, Henry, around this defence pact that has been agreed between the United States,
Britain,
Australia, and Britain, with neither France, who are obviously particularly annoyed because it involved some cancellation of a deal to buy, I think, submarines, and Canada. And people said, the Conservatives used that as an attack argument, saying, well, Trudeau was such an irrelevance that they didn't want him involved. Now, Henry, I mean, how much Canada realistically would have been playing a role in this, I think, is open to debate. But it didn't. I don't think Trudeau appreciated it. I think he would have liked to have been asked to be involved, and it would have looked good for him.
Well, it has to be asked.
I think because there would be a perception, certainly in the US, that Trudeau had tried to cozy up to China, and was not seen as taking what Joe Biden would see as a security threat from China seriously enough, that he was much more focused on trade and things like that.
I just want to ask you a broad question about Canada in terms of, you know, when we went into Iraq in, first of all, 1991 and then again in 2003, it's always Australia, Britain and America and sometimes France and some other countries. Where did Canada play into the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan?
They did send troops, Henry, into Afghanistan, but they were in very clear, and in Iraq, but very clearly defined roles. That they were not combat. It was much more
like training
and medical training stuff, for all the good that did, training Afghan troops. Fled like frightened mice as soon as the Taliban appeared. But so, yes, much more sort of. I mean, Canadian military operations have largely been in the sphere of peacekeeping and providing support to other sort of NATO-led operations in broadly that capacity, as opposed to really getting involved in the heavy end stuff, if you like, which sort of fits Canada's sort of reputation as a kind of
a very polite mediator
and polite, you know, we're here to solve problems.
It's important, isn't it? I mean, that stuff's really important to keep things moving, you know?
It is. I mean, I would not describe, and I think it is a big cultural difference between Canada and the US, I would not describe Canada as a kind of militaristic kind of country, you know, and everyone going on, you know, protect our troops and that kind of thing. Of course, people in Canada fully respect, as they should, the service given to our men and women in uniform. But it is not brash. It is not about, you know, overt displays of militarism that you might see, for example, at sporting events in the US. That just really doesn't happen here. It's much more understated. And it's much more, as I say, in the context of logistical support for NATO as a NATO member and in sort of peacekeeping.
Yeah, and rightly so, I think. I keep on hearing the adage, Canadians leave their doors open at night. Is that true still?
Well, depending where you are, Henry. Where I live, yes, you could. I mean, I live in a suburb. Myself and my partner built a new house in an area called Headingley, which is a suburb outside of Winnipeg. And it's a new housing development, and it is dead quiet at night, and there's really not nobody. In fact, even the local police, the local RCMP, do actually patrol around here. Now, not that I've ever seen anything, but in other areas, I mean, in a city, Winnipeg, the North End, I don't think anybody would be leaving their doors open at night, but really depends where you are. You know?
Would you ever consider living in America?
No.
Just take your time, Ronan.
No. I like the United States of America. I have many friends in the United States of America. Visited it for work, visited it for holiday, but I don't have, particularly at this point in its history, a desire to live there. I see it as an incredibly divided country. The Republican Party appears to have completely lost its mind and has become basically a personality cult of Donald Trump, which I just find repulsive.
Yes.
And I think it's just become a very, very fractured, divisive place. Now, having said that, many, many Americans, of course, are exceptionally nice people and kind-hearted people. It's sports fantastic, it's entertainment fantastic. But I think, you know, if I was living in certain parts of America, I'd probably find it really hard to sort of deal with diehard Trump supporters on a daily basis. You know?
Yeah, there must be a sense of stress.
That you just don't have in Canada. I mean, you get the odd, but they're a tiny minority. I mean, as I say, Aaron O'Toole could not in any way be compared to Donald Trump. You know?
No, he's not, nowhere near there.
He just
seems
a Democrat, you know.
Yeah. Look, I think it's pretty laid back. I've never been there, actually. Of course, Canada is a Commonwealth country, as is Australia. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of similarities between these two countries in terms of size. I think your population's notably bigger than ours. But very same kind of sense of, I think we feel safe in Australia, you know? And we look at America and think, what the hell is going on in that country?
Yes, I agree. There are important cultural differences here. A big one, obviously, is guns. I mean, like in Australia, they're incredibly strict gun laws. Canada, you cannot go to a gun store and buy a handgun. It's illegal.
Yeah.
There are all sorts of requirements around, like semi-automatics are banned. Mm. You kind of have guns for sporting purposes, like Olympic shooting, and for hunting. But again, there's registry laws, there's laws around storage. It's a completely different society in relation to firearms. The other difference that Canada has always trumped is healthcare. You know, that like in Australia, there's a public health system here, and it's largely you know, free at the point of delivery, funded by taxes, unlike the situation in the US, which is largely a private insurance system. So, yes. And it's more stable. I there's no question politically that Canada is a far more stable and still, leaving aside everything that happened in the federal election, it's a functioning democracy.
Yeah.
Governments change hands here federally and provincially, peacefully. People accept the results of election. I mean, nobody, Henry, was talking about fraud or anything like that at the end of the election, for a simple reason, there wasn't any.
And but there Canadians wasn't any in just, America either.
Canadians just trust the kind of decent people who are their accounting folks, yes. Or they're just regular folks, their neighbours, you know.
Absolutely. If you've just joined us, I'm talking with Ronan Seagrave in Winnipeg, Canada. He's our correspondent in North America, and I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia. Look, R. Kelly. Now, I know that I must be living under a rock. Given that I do a radio show, you think I'd know more about music or other things. But this guy, R. Kelly, you apparently very successful singer, songwriter.
Yes, I mean, R. Kelly is one of the most successful R&B artists of all time, and certainly one of the most influential. He sold over 75 million records. He's written hits for other people, including Michael Jackson, where he wrote the hit "You Were Not Alone." Hugely influential. His track "Ignition" is ranked by Rolling Stone as a top 500 track of all time. People with his most well-known hits, probably "I Believe I Could Fly" and "If You Could Turn Back the Hands of Time." Mm. Beautiful soul voice. But he's also a serious and repulsive sex offender, as we now know.
Since was the convicted. 1990s?
Yeah, but allegations emerged firstly in the 1990s, and they emerged, they were about underage sex with girls who were underage, and involved an allegation. There was a singer called Aaliyah Henry. She died in a plane crash in 2002. Yeah. But she was alleged to have, in inverted commas, married R. Kelly when she was 15, based on forged documents that say that she was 18. Tapes emerged in the late 90s, and he was prosecuted, I think, firstly in 2002 for him being taped having sex with an underage girl. I won't even get into what's in the tape, Henry. It's just repulsive. Yeah. But R. Kelly, after lengthy legal battles back and forth, was eventually acquitted of those charges in 2008. But the rumours and the allegations that he was essentially running Henry, the only way I can describe it is having multiple young women and girls underage living in a compound and basically working as sex slaves, for want of a better description, and very distressed parents trying to get their children back from R. Kelly. And this all culminated, Henry, in a documentary that Netflix did in 2019, which made very serious allegations against R. Kelly. It involved relatives, sisters of, and indeed some women who had escaped R. Kelly's clutches, making very serious allegations of underage sex, statutory rape, if you want. Mm. This culminated in Kelly being arrested last year and being charged with a whole range of offences, Henry. Largely in what would be described as sex trafficking, or known as the Mann Act in the US, Henry, which is essentially the transportation of young girls under the age of consent across state lines and having unlawful sexual intercourse. And he was also convicted of that, Henry, today, and also convicted of racketeering he's facing, Henry, multiple decades of jail. He will not be sentenced on these string of charges until May of next year, but he's also facing very similar charges also in Illinois and in Minnesota. So, you know, the chances of R. Kelly ever getting out of jail are slim to none.
Sorry to interrupt you. This is racketeering, obviously. We know about that. The underage trafficking of girls, was this all within America, or was...
This was all within America, Henry, right. Yeah. I mean, R. Kelly rarely travelled outside of the US, even for touring purposes. All within the US. I mean, we had this debate on Messenger about, you know, R. Kelly's now been convicted and nearly facing more charges. And we were just sort of messaging, but it begs an awful but a question. Can you separate the music of somebody from the person? And there's no denying R. Kelly's a repulsive human being, but there's no denying the man has an incredible voice and could write incredible songs. Are they never to be heard again? Can we? And this all came up, Henry, a couple of years ago with Michael Jackson.
Indeed.
There was the Finding Neverland documentary where two men, boys at the time, made allegations that Michael Jackson had sexually assaulted and molested them. And at that time, and I don't know whether it was a case in Australia, but radio stations in Canada stopped playing Michael Jackson's music.
Mm.
And I think what they expected, Henry, as frankly I did, from that documentary, there was going to be a sort of tidal wave of further, you know, men coming out and more allegations being made against Michael Jackson. That didn't happen. Now, I'm not questioning, Henry, the two men in that program, that they were lying, and I'm not accusing them of that. It was actually quite convincing.
Yes,
but that didn't happen. And so, you know, suddenly Canadian radio stations started playing Michael Jackson music again, and to no sort of public outcry.
Mm.
And his music is played every day on Canadian radio and on various different stations. I'm sure it is in Australia and everywhere else.
Absolutely.
Will that be the case with R. Kelly?
Yeah. And also,
possibly not. You know?
Interesting. You know, there's some questions that come to mind. R. Kelly, hugely successful as a singer songwriter. Why got lots of money, I'm sure. Why would he do this? It's not for the money. It seems to me, and also the other question I have about this is, he's such a public figure. How did he manage to do all this as a public? I mean, the paparazzi are always following people like him around.
Well, he certainly led Henry quite a reclusive life, and the girls who were in this kind of horrible situation described as incredibly coercive. You know, Kelly making threats if they ever spoke out.
Mm.
Any time these allegations were raised, you know, Kelly's lawyers would get involved and say they're not true. He was obviously a powerful figure within, and people do women have testified to the extent of his quite powerful personality and dominating personality. I think the truth of the matter is that R. Kelly is a borderline paedophile and sexual deviant. You can't come to any other conclusions about him. He's just a bad man in that respect, and an evil man, and he needs to be punished.
Mm.
But he's one that also happened to have an incredible talent, if you like, in terms of music. But it does seem, and he picked on, you know, when you think he picked on vulnerable
young
girls. You know,
it's not
just horrible. It's disgusting. It's repulsive. He is an obnoxious, vile individual, and he deserves to spend the rest of his life in prison. There's no question about that.
Which he probably will. What intrigues
he's facing decades, Henry.
Yeah. What intrigues me is that, I don't know if I'm right about this, but it seems to me that this all came about because of a television show from Netflix. Interesting that the media has to do this? Or
it was surviving our... I mean, I actually watched it. It was.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
It was gripping. I mean, in a way that was highly disturbing, I have to say.
Did they interview in that?
They interviewed multiple
victims.
Victims of R. Kelly were interviewed. Their family, the distress, to put it mildly, that this man has caused is incomprehensible to those families, to those girls who suffered from his horrific sexual abuse. The man was a monster, Henry. There's no other way, I'm afraid, you can describe it. But the program was absolutely damning and devastating in relation to R. Kelly, and it provoked women now really coming forward and cooperating with the legal authorities to ensure that R. Kelly met his justice today. You know,
I just want to say again, isn't this really interesting that it takes the media to expose this monster? And why did it take a show to do this? I don't understand. Why weren't the cops onto this, you know?
I mean, it's a great question, Henry. I mean, one comparison I thought it was Jimmy Savile. I mean, for listeners, Jimmy Savile was a children's television presenter and disc jockey and presenter of Top of the Pops in the UK. You know, almost a revered figure, Henry, and
raised
millions,
yes.
who's turned out to be probably the worst and the most notorious paedophile in British history. And you ask the question again, how did he get away with it?
For so long.
I think the similarities between R. Kelly and Jimmy Savile is they were both dominating and very strong personalities. They both had lots of money. They were both able to use lawyers to issue threats, you know, newspapers printing, you know, threatening to sue, buying people off with money, and so similar sort of tactics we used. In Jimmy Savile's case, it was also cozying up to sort of the powerful, you know, friends of Margaret Thatcher and Prince Charles and people like that. Interestingly, Henry, speaking of Jimmy Savile, somewhat controversially for some people, ITV are going to make a drama about Jimmy Savile and the actor and comedian Steve Coogan after, I think, and he has said this, much deliberation, himself personally has decided to play the part.
Who's Steve Coogan?
Now, Steve Coogan will play Jimmy Savile. Now,
oh, how interesting.
I have mixed feelings about this. I mean, on the one hand, you know, Jimmy Savile just makes my skin crawl, as I'm sure it's the reaction for everybody. At the same time, perhaps this does need to be made in respect of really just illustrating what happened, and it can never happen again.
You know,
Steve Coogan is such a wonderful actor.
He is fantastic, isn't he? You know, I have these horrific images as a child myself of watching Jimmy Savile on television with children on his lap on a show called Jim'll Fix It, and that just sends shivers up my spine.
Well, there's actually a clip, Henry, of and in fact, the woman was one of the people who came forward, of him actually presenting Top of the Pops and him actually sexually assaulting a girl on television. She sort of there jumping and squealing.
I saw that.
When you think about
it, I mean, that television. Was
on national television, you know, in plain sight. Jimmy Savile was in plain sight. And you know, No doubt, Steve Coogan is a wonderful actor, and he's been very clear that he deliberated about this for quite some time. He doesn't need the money or to play this part, but he felt there was a
sense of responsibility
for making this.
Yeah,
a sense of responsibility to make this program and to actually, you know, if it has some value from his perspective around how we never end up here again with somebody placed in that kind of a powerful position.
I bet it won't be shown on the BBC.
It's ITV actually that are doing it.
Yeah, of course. Just to explain to our audience, you know, Jimmy Savile was a BBC person, you know.
He was a BBC person. I mean, he was a BBC person. And, you know, I always remember an interview with Tony Blackburn, who was a contemporary of Jimmy Savile working for the BBC. He presented Top of the Pops often with Jimmy Savile. He was on Radio 1. And he was interviewed and he was asked, you know, did you know? And he said, no, I didn't.
Yeah.
He said there were stories and rumours. And he said, what did you think of Jimmy Savile? He said, I never liked him. And he said, our relationship, I just thought he was an odd, not very pleasant individual. I worked with him when I had to, and that was it. There was no kind of personal relationship. But he said, you know, and he was just horrified by what came out.
And they were both working on, you know, Top of the Pops, which was this huge Thursday night broadcast together. And, of course, Radio 1, the national pop station. You know, Tony Blackburn, who I speak with regularly on social media, you couldn't really get away from each other, you know, all these DJs from Radio 1. So it must have been uncomfortable for Tony Blackburn.
Very. I think any of his sort of contemporaries, I think, have found this incredibly difficult and have found this incredibly painful. And I think, you know, for the BBC, obviously, it's led to an enormous amount of soul searching in respect, you know, why did this happen? I mean, let's be clear about it. Serious criminal offences took place in its television studios and on its property.
Yeah,
and it went on for so long, and you know, Jimmy Savile was being revered as some kind of saint.
He was like a god, wasn't he? I mean,
he was like a guy. I mean, the charity stuff, you know, doing
all
his
the
walks
charity
and his
stuff.
Runs,
he was abusing. He was sexually abusing disabled people. I mean, it's horrific.
Yes, necrophilia. Even I mean, just horrific
just
stuff.
Bad stuff. Oh God!
You know, he was an awful evil man. You know?
We'll have to leave all this evilness. Before we go, I just want to end on a lighter note. You had a really hot summer in Canada.
Unbelievably, Henry. Yeah.
And now are you going to get a really cold winter?
We don't know. I mean, this was a very hot summer. I mean, where I was in Winnipeg, we had very little rain. I mean, it was a full-blown drought and days, you know, well into sort of the 30s, day after day. I mean, British Columbia had temperatures hitting near 50 and well into the 40s. And we had obviously horrendous summer with forest fires, entire towns in BC sort of being burnt down. In the federal election, Henry, it did mean some focus on climate change. This is something in Canada we have to take just unbelievably seriously.
Yes.
In terms of addressing it. We don't know, Henry. I mean, last winter in Winnipeg, and just for listeners, it can get quite cold here in winter. I mean, temperatures of minus 30, minus 40 are not unheard of, and with the wind chill, it can even feel even colder. I mean, it can be colder than Mars here. Last winter was actually quite mild. We had long stretches
What's mild, Ronan?
Well, by that I mean we had days and days where it was sort of minus five, minus six. Actually quite pleasant.
Did you ever want to go back to Ireland for a summer holiday where it's only minus three?
Some days. You know, the one thing about it, though, I will say, is that it's a very dry cold. And that's easier to deal with than what I call a wet cold.
Yeah.
Because it really gets into your bones. What's horrible here is the wind.
And when you get that wind chill, it is absolutely,
you know, it will cut you in two. It's like steel. You know, it can, as I say, it can take it down to minus 40 below. And it's really unsafe to be staying out in that for any length of time.
Yes. At least with COVID, people are working from home.
That was also handy last winter. Maybe we just weren't going out at all. We were sort of in permanent lockdown. The other thing we didn't have a whole lot last winter was snow. I mean, you can get just meters and meters of stuff here, but we didn't have a whole lot. And the old Farmer's Almanac will be coming out very shortly and attempting to make a long-term prediction in relation to the winter. And the other thing that is hard here is just how long it drags on for, Henry. I mean, snow can start falling here from late October, early November, and it can still be falling in April. So it is...
Snowplows,
you know, or... Yeah, January and February can be just absolutely horrific. Snowplows, you're obviously checking the weather, checking windshield, checking your vehicles, and that all the time. I mean, our houses here, the house I'm in, is built for two things. One, a terrific air conditioning system which cools it down nicely. I have it on now, Henry, because it hit about 29 today. That's much hotter than it normally is this time of year. Yeah, it's hot again tomorrow and then cools down a bit. We're in sort of, normally here it's about 15, 16 is about the average for this time of the year. But it was really hot today. And then in the winter, you've got incredible heating systems with vents in every room.
Of course, your house is new, isn't that right? It's just,
powered by natural gas.
We've got a lot of
in Canada. And the one thing about it, Henry, is because the winters here are so severe, they may creep up, but energy prices here are quite low, and they have to be kept low because of just the amount of
gas. People need to survive in these extreme temperatures.
I mean, you've got basically your heating on full for months, you know, and you've got to be able to survive in it.
Okay, Ronan, we're so out of time. Look, thank you so much for joining me from Canada once again here on Bondi Tunes.
A pleasure, Henry. Take care.
This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio.
Remember. sun never sets on Bondi Tunes.